Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, people love positing theories on what were the most important years in popular music, right? And in fairness, it does sometimes coincide with the 50th anniversary of those years. I'd argue that a lot of the time those people don't know what they're talking about, but today we have top quality analysis. So author and music obsessive Joseph O'Connor, good afternoon, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Brendan, good to see you.
So Joe, you're positing that 1975, 50 years ago, was a pivotal year in popular music. Now, it wouldn't be one of the more generally recognised seminal years for music. So very broadly first, why was 1975 a milestone year?
Well, it's incredible the number of albums that are still thought to be important and still loved, still listened to, that came out in 1975. Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, Patti Smith's Horses, Bob Marley Live, Fleetwood Mac, Dark Side of the Moon, and On They Go. And it may be because the world in 1975 was in a bit of a state of chassis.
Okay, give us a picture of that.
Well, there's a lot of upheaval, there's a lot of turbulence and change. 1975 is the end of the Vietnam War. It's the resignation of President Nixon after the serious dent to American self-image that was Watergate. There's revolution in Portugal. There's the arrival of Mrs. Thatcher on the political scene. Two assassination attempts on President Ford. Our own island is going through a terrible phase of the Troubles. The Miami Show Band Massacre, it's 1975. There's a sense that old eras and old ways of thinking are changing and that there's uncertainty ahead. And sometimes when that happens, you do see a great kind of upsurge in artistic and creative endeavour.
So, yeah, so people think of 1977, the year punk broke, as the reset and the beginning of modern music. And that, in a way, sometimes people kind of dismiss that it rendered everything that came before kind of irrelevant and bloated and, you know, not urgent. But punk, I suppose, didn't come from nowhere either. So were the seeds of that reset being sown in 1975?
I think they were. I think there was in the work of people like Patti Smith, an amazing ability to look forward as well as back. I mean, she was somebody who revered Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Van Morrison and the Beat Groups and the Velvet Underground, all of them. But she had a new way of kind of putting her influences together. A lot of the punks would later reveal that secretly they liked ABBA and secretly they liked Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, and that they loved glam. You know, Johnny Rotten once confessed that he loved Slade and the Sweet. But I suppose that era is coming to an end. I mean, the high phase of glam, kind of 1971 to 1975, it's beginning to run out of steam. I suppose the leader of the movement, if there was one, David Bowie, turning away from glam. His 1975 album, Young Americans, is leaning more towards American soul and Motown. It's just this sense that old ways of thinking, old ways of music aren't going to work anymore. So I think...
It was the era still of David Essex, the Bay City Rollers, Top of the Pops on Thursday night?
Top of the Pops,
originally.
Thursday night. Nobody who was younger than us will ever be able to connect with just how
important. And the importance of it,
People would go home and gather around the telly and watch for half an hour strange-looking pop stars miming to their songs, and it was just the most fantastic highlight of your week. It helped you get through the week, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of measured the week around
Appointment
Top of the
TV.
Pops.
Yeah. So the 75 is kind of probably peak Top of the Pops.
It's peak Top of the Pops. It's peak album sales. I mean, 1975, if you research it, it was then the highest number of albums ever sold was in 1975. It wasn't unknown that if you had a hit album, it could sell 10 million copies. It wasn't yet the era of huge tours. I mean, if you were a teenager in Ireland in 1975, big gigs very rarely happened. It was the era of the cassette recorder, that wonderful thing that you got sometimes for Christmas, and you held it up to the telly and pressed play and record, and you could, you know, disseminate.
Okay, so
music.
You were doing it off the telly at that stage, because it would be like waiting to press it for during fanning in my era.
Play and record at the same time, and so you could swap music with your friends. So that, I think the technology of it was important.
And of course, albums back then as well were, two old men talking. Now, but people would say they were a much more tactile thing of beauty, gatefold sleeves, amazing art, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, we don't want to go too much into kind of Shady Pines territory. There were bad things about 1975, as I've mentioned, but albums were beautiful objects. Gavin Friday, who was on your show recently, the great man that he is, once said in an interview that he used to buy two copies of the latest Bowie album. One was to play and the other was to carry around under his arm, because it was your way of identifying yourself and letting the world know what kind of person you were.
And you would attract live, like-minded souls, wouldn't you, by parading with the right album.
Spot each other across the school playground
with your
David Bowie album or your Neil Young or your Bruce Springsteen or whatever it was. And that said, you know, I'm in this club. What club are you in? So I think music had that huge importance. The charts were actually very varied, far more than they are now. Some of the records we're going to play today probably wouldn't be on Top of the Pops now if it was still with us. So there was an openness, there was a curiosity, and there's a great sense of things changing and new music coming.
Okay, so one of the albums you've mentioned, Patti Smith's Horses from 1975. What is it about this album and about Patti Smith that was important?
So I bought this album in a dingy little basement, Freebird Records, which was then at the time on the North Quays of the Liffey. And you went down the stairs into this hovel that smelt of patchouli oil and other fragrances, and an aunt in London had sent me £10 as a birthday gift, a princely sum at the time. So in I went to Freebird Records, leafing through the punk records, and their covers were mainly kind of Day Glow and Blackmail style lettering. And in the middle of the pile, came across this extraordinary black and white image of a young person who was androgynous looking. You weren't totally sure if this is a man or a woman, like a still from one of those cool French movies with the jacket thrown over her shoulder. And it was the photograph of Patti Smith by Robert Mapplethorpe. And it's really the only album that I've ever bought for its cover. I hadn't heard of the album at the time. Took it home, put it on. Had never heard anything like it in terms of its freshness, how raw it was. Women performers in particular did not present themselves in that way at that time. As I said, it seemed to look backwards as well as forwards. Patti Smith is often described as like the high priestess of punk rock, but she was so much more than that. By the time punk came along, she was an established figure in the kind of downtown New York poetry countercultural scene. And that's a big part of the record. There are parts when she speaks, there are parts when she sings, this amazing voice that's able to go like from a whisper to a scream in a couple of seconds, produced by a member of the Velvet Underground. So it has that amazing rawness. Her fella at the time was Sam Shepherd, and her good friend at the time was Allen Ginsberg, and they would drop into the studio during the recording sessions for Horses. And so I think Horses has this amazing ability that you kind of feel you're there in the room, Electric Ladyland Studios in New York, that you're standing there in the booth as Patti Smith and her band do their thing. It's just an explosive sound.
Let's take a flavour of it. So the track you've chosen is Free Money.
Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills swirling at my bed. I know they're stolen, but I don't be bad. I take that money, buy you things you never had. Oh, baby.
Okay, that's Patti Smith and Free Money. That's from the album Horses. Yeah, you can see there that like it's not a complete break with the past.
It's looking both ways and harking back to some of the great musicians. But also, you know, if you look up the people who were subsequently influenced by Patti Smith, include Morrissey, Michael Stipe, PJ Harvey, Nick Cave, Fiona Apple, Tori Amos. You know, I think it's just a hugely important record that's up there with the Sex Pistols and the Clash. But Patti was out there doing her thing 2 or 3 years before, and 1975 debut album Horses that really changed many people's lives.
Okay, so the next one you picked might surprise people. It's not a debut album. I think Born to Run was Bruce Springsteen's third album in 1975. What was it about this that clicked for him and for the audience?
Well, I think it is important that what we were saying earlier about what's happening in America is part of the background of Born to Run, that you have an America that is coming to a number of serious realizations about itself and its role in the world and how people look at it and how they look at themselves. And I suppose folk music and blues music had been such an important part of the 60s in terms of defining those things. Now all of that is sort of coming to an end. American dreams are in ashes, and along comes Bruce. And somehow he is able to take these embers and turn them into this amazing kind of beacon of song that's to do with America being a vast country and a diverse country where many, many people are welcomed, and a place of freedom. And I suppose if there's one word running through all of the songs we're going to play today, it's that. It's very striking. They all have this kind of yearning for freedom. And so many of Bruce's songs touch on the Vietnam War. It's very striking how often the I character in a song is someone who's been in the war, who's been touched by it. And of course, dozens of them are about roads and openness and going places and new horizons. And I think it's one of the reasons why we connect with them in a particular way here in Ireland is that it does have very deep roots in the folk tradition. And in some ways, I think Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, it's where folk music had to go. I think what he did saved American folk music and broke it into a kind of new territory.
And it's interesting, you're saying he took the classic notion of the American dream and freedom and everything, but put that kind of the disappointment of blue collar America. That's
it's definitely there, but he still there's an optimism, there's an appeal to what Abraham Lincoln used to call the better angels of the American nature. He's saying, look, things have gone so wrong, but there's still this country and there's still things that we can do. And of course, the greatest thing that America has done in terms of culture is the pop song. I mean, America doesn't have many great classical musicians or many great painters, but it's given us
jazz,
songs.
Blues and rock and roll.
And I think Bruce is kind of very aware of all of those traditions. He's got a great big kind of Phil Spector wall of sound.
Yeah, but why are we not playing Born to Run? Like, which I think he spent most of the time making this album getting Born to Run right, didn't he?
It's hard to pick which one you would play. He spent six months literally on the track Born to Run. It was the third album, as you say. I think there was a sense that this is it. It's make or break. He took most of the budget that was available and he spent it on Born to Run.
But you picked Thunder Road.
I think Thunder Road is just so moving and so powerful, so beautifully written. And I think it does connect with Irish people in a particular way.
Here it is. Okay, that's Thunder Road from Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
If I had hair, I would roll down the window and blow back.
I suppose were they different times as well, in terms of just saying that he could spend 6 months getting Born to Run right? Like, kind of up to pretty much quite recently before then, you were booked a week in a studio, weren't you? And band was thrown in and told to make an album there. Clearly big money.
No, it's astonishing when you look at like some of the early Beatles albums were kind of made in 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 nights. Elvis's first records made in, you know, an afternoon session. But there was a sense by the middle of the 1970s that a hit album is very big money. And I think, you know, that there were powerful international record companies who wanted to take that punt in the hope that it would work and that they would end up with an album that would never go away. And that's what happened with Born to Run. It still sells millions of copies.
You mentioned Dylan's Blood in the Tracks. So this is kind of another phenomenon. There were survivors around from the 60s, Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, that kind of thing, and they managed to successfully kind of reinvent for a new era.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating things about 1975. It's the number of people from the 60s who have this kind of amazing second wave of creativity that you do sometimes see, so that it's not all new, it's not all experimentation, it's some of the people who've been up and running for a while getting, you know, a second wind and just coming up with some of the work that defines their whole careers. Blood on the Tracks is 13 years after Dylan's first album, but it has the rawness of a first album. And yet the writing is more sophisticated, it's more autobiographical. Dylan being Dylan, he has both denied and confirmed that some of the songs are the result of things that have happened to him. I think what he actually has is like the true artist's ability to say that autobiographical stuff can be connected to the experience of other people. So if you've ever had a breakup, if you've ever been in love and fallen out of love, which is all of us, There are things on Blood in the Tracks that are going to speak to you. Beautiful album. They're like short stories, as well as being songs, as well as having that kind of bluesy folk truth to them. And if I had to pick one favourite Dylan album, which thank God I don't, I think Blood on the Tracks would be very high near the top.
Okay, and here's a bit of Tangled Up in Blue.
The sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress, Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through.
Okay, that's Tangled Up in Blue, and that's from Blood on the Tracks.
Yes.
A lot of Dylanologists will tell me that is the one. Like,
yeah, there are great Dylan albums from around the same time. Desire is a fantastic album, but Blood on the Tracks certainly up there. I was just struck listening to it now how, as with the Springsteen, it's about a road, the opening voice, about somebody setting off on a journey. And I think that does define a lot of the music that was around in 1975. We've been down the old roads, we're going to new places, and just striking that image comes up again there.
And of course, protest songs, a feature of every era, but probably more so back in the 60s and 70s. So another landmark album you've chosen is Bob Marley and the Wailers Live. This was recorded at the Lyceum in London, and this was kind of a big breakthrough for him. As you know, the phrase they used to use, I don't know if it's right to say this anymore, but the first third world superstar. But this was the beginning of the breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't the first time that Bob Marley had played London, but the band were just absolutely on fire by now. And it's the moment. I mean, it's a particular night in July 1975. Where, like, every music fan has the gig that they would have loved to go back in the time machine and see. Yeah. And I would have loved to be there in the Lyceum Theatre that night. You have to remember about Bob Marley, this is an era where there is still on British television a show called the Black and White Minstrel Show, where white
people... That was still on
still,
then.
Still on until 1978. The appearance of black people in sitcoms, even some of the great sitcoms, you know, black people, all foreigners, but in particular people of colour, are there to be laughed at and mocked. And then along comes Bob Marley, who's singing in his own voice and his own language and his own patois about, like, his God and his way of looking at the world, just making it clear, I am not going to be anybody's minstrel. And it brings back a beautiful memory that I have of going to see Bob Marley playing in Dublin, the only time he did, in Dalyman Park, 45 years ago today.
As
it happens. One of the all-time great gigs. I loved Bob Marley. Got into him first by listening to interviews with Phil Lynott, who was very interesting about Phil was a bass guitarist, as you know. He wrote his songs on bass. He didn't use piano. And I remember listening to him talking about the importance of the bass in reggae music. So it's a major moment in the history of reggae and protest music, and it's just a storming live gig.
Why do Irish people have such a connection with Bob Marley?
I think it's to do with the past and oppression and just his beautiful music. But we do. I mean, it's interesting, for example, the gig was in Daily Mount Park.
Yeah.
There is a Bohemians Away strip that has Bob Marley's face on it. Like, I can remember growing up in Dunleary and hearing kids with the Ghetto Blaster playing Bob Marley on the pier late at night. So it's a combination of admiration for how he speaks for his people and our own love of folk music, because in a way that's what Bob Marley is doing. It's very authentic music from the streets, but with the addition of the beautiful vocals of his backing singers, the I3s, and just the fantastic band, the Wailers. It's an irresistible package.
Okay, let's go back to that hot London night at the Lyceum. This is Bob Marley, Dem Belly Full But I Hungry. Okay, that's Bob Marley, Dem Belly Full But I Hungry, and that is from Bob Marley and the Wailers live, and that is another landmark album that Joe O'Connor has picked from 1975. Interesting, the version of No Woman, No Cry from that live album was Bob Marley's first big hit single internationally. Like you were saying earlier about the singles charts being full of all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that that became a hit single, this long kind of sprawling, not perfectly recorded thing from a live album, kind of broke out and became a huge hit single.
Absolutely, there are kind of glitches and the odd bum note, but what's being sold to you as the beautiful experience is the fact that it's live. And the singles were very experimental. 1975, of course, is perhaps then the most experimental single of all time, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody,
which is six
minutes long. It is not possible on paper that a 6 minute long song melding opera and heavy metal and Freddie Mercury's vocals can get to number one in the charts, but it did, and it stayed at number one for more than any other single then had. So there was an openness, a kind of looseness, and a feeling of, you know, what's coming next.
Yeah, cool. And what was coming next was ABBA. So they won Eurovision in 74. 75, they released the album you've chosen, the ABBA album. And it was Mamma Mia became a massive hit for them off of this album, didn't it? That was the real beginning of their superstardom.
You weren't supposed to really like ABBA. Yeah. You know, you weren't, if you were chatting to your mates about how you loved this.
Were you carrying around an ABBA arrival walking around out in
Dunleary? In my heart, Brendan. And I've been very struck over the last few years looking at interviews with Glenn Matlock of the Pistols and various people who were in the Clash, and Susie and the Banshees, of Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols, great guitarist, how they all kind of secretly liked ABBA. And it's hard not to love ABBA. And one of the reasons I'm playing this now today is it's my beloved's birthday tomorrow. And at our wedding reception 28 years ago, we had a DJ, and a decrepit old man turned up carrying record boxes. I thought he actually must be the DJ's granddad, but he was the DJ. And being both music fans, we had given him a playlist that had, you know, the Smiths and Echo and the Bunny Men and Killing Joke and all those bands. And after about 40 minutes, he came over to me and he said, well, I can continue playing your stuff if you want. But if you'd like to have people dancing in 30 seconds, I can do that for you. So we said, oh, go ahead and do it. So on came Mamma Mia. So I'm going to play it for my beloved to say thank you for being married to me for 28 years. It was a lovely day.
Come to an end.
Okay. That's Mamma Mia.
Just one look and I could hear a bell ring. I mean, Yeats would have liked to write that, Brendan.
So listen, we can be very simplistic about thinking of eras of music. This is one year and the standout albums are Patti Smith, Dylan, Bob Marley, then ABBA. And then the last one you've chosen is a really interesting choice, right? I'm always surprised how early Roxy Music were around.
Yeah.
Because in many ways they're so ahead of their time. But then you look back, this music is 50 years old, right?
This music,
Kraftwerk were around then.
Yeah.
A lot of disco was going kind of more electronic, and it could have been from now. I often think it's like, imagine if when I was growing up in the 80s, music from the 30s was a completely different beast. Like, we wouldn't have listened to it. I don't know what it was, like, you know, Rosemary Clooney or whatever. But somehow this music, Roxy Music, are a very modern band still. Like,
they just sum up a lot of the things that we've been talking about today. They did their own thing. I mean, I think a lot of the great bands, I mean, the hallmark, whether it's the Beach Boys or the Stones or Dexy's Midnight Runners or the Pogues, the hallmark is that they don't just do brilliant music, they invite you into the world. They have a way of kind of looking at things.
Yeah.
They kind of seem to say to you, like, in your own head, you're free. Nobody can govern what's going on inside your head. You can go anywhere you want. I remember looking at Top of the Pops one night when Roxy Music were on, and my granddad was in the room, and I remember him saying, "What are they like?" And it's actually the best question that was ever asked about Roxy Music, because they weren't like anything.
Yeah,
they were like themselves. They could be dressed as pirates or World War II fighters or in Brian Eno's case, like aliens.
Leather pilot's
eye patches. And you know, they just did their own thing. And I think musically, they're such an interesting band, the way they banged together different kinds of sounds. They had a brilliant drummer, but they used oboes and clarinets and synths. And then over the top, you had this extraordinary kind of lounge lizard crooning voice of Brian Ferry.
Who, not forgetting Eno, who was so important early on, doesn't
play on this record, but it's definitely there in the background. Brian Ferry had an amazing ability to extemporize lyrics. He would be able to just turn up and improvise them on the spot. And he didn't do that with this song. He had written some of them, but on the night in question when they recorded, nobody had heard them. So people gathered in the booth to watch if Brian could get himself into the zone and deliver the vocal, which he did first time. And at the end of the recording, 3 minutes later, everybody in the building burst into applause, and they knew this was a song that's still
going to be. So they had heard Love is the Drug.
They'd heard
for the first time.
Yeah. And just again, hugely influential, Talking Heads, U2, The Smiths, you know, the new romantic bands, Radiohead, they all come back to Roxy Music.
Really, yeah. So they're actually much underrated as an influential, important band, yeah?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the people who love their music and who love pop music, if you talk to them for longer than 10 minutes, Roxy will come up. I think it's also to do with, you know, 1975, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of turbulence in the world, there's a lot of unemployment, and the towns up and down England and Ireland that are kind of rainy, monochrome places, and then you switch on Top of the Pops, on comes Roxy Music, and it's like diving to a reef of beautiful, strange creatures who just do their own thing and who seem to say, you can do your thing too. It mightn't be the same as our thing, but we can all do our thing, and that music makes you free in a way that nothing else does. And I think that's another reason why they've lasted so long.
Okay, before we finish up, Brendan, respect to Joe, but he's 4 years too late for the best year, which is, of course, 1971. The 1971 argument has been made. We're interested in fresh arguments.
Yeah.
Top of the Pops really was the highlight, this person says. Then I discovered the old grey whistle test. Fantastic memories. And, of course, that went a bit deeper and more authentic than Top of the Pops.
That was
did,
more your album tracks.
Yes, exactly.
And it could be a bit proggy. You
might be there a while with some of the songs.
It'd be very long flute solos.
At last, someone who knows what he's talking about. His great taste in music and give insight. What a great turn of phrase. I could listen to Joseph for hours. Someone saying the Wailers were incredible at the Night and Day Festival in Roscommon, so authentic, as Joseph says, spent ages afterwards talking to young people in the crowd. Someone says, so Bob Marley in Daily Mount in 1980. It wasn't at the concert, but fortunately, my parents chose that day to visit a well-known furniture warehouse which backed onto Dalymount, I encouraged my folks to try out scores of sofas and got to hear a good 30 minutes of the concert. I've never been more fond of brown velour sofas. And someone else, and this is an important point for the young people. Don't forget that we had to save up for weeks to buy an album. You were careful to pick the right one because it would be weeks or even months before you could buy the next one. With streaming these days, I can listen to absolutely anything ever recorded, but have trouble sometimes finding something I want to listen to. Less is very much more. And Peter, I see your point on one hand, but on the other hand, it does get you to try out more music, because it was a big investment, Joe, wasn't it? You'd have to be kind of sure.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I think Spotify is an amazing thing. I mean, I think the era of music that we're living through now is really incredible in terms of how easy it is to access music.
Like, if you decide you want to get interested in old dub reggae or whatever, you
can get a playlist in 30 seconds. At the same time, it was a bit of a ceremony. It was a great joy thinking of what album will I get going into town, going to the shop. The physical look at the sleeves themselves, often the artwork was amazing. Often the liner notes are very interesting. And they're beautiful objects, but we can't have too much nostalgia.
Yeah, and look, and I'm conscious as well, there were people all over the country as well, you know, who had to buy mail order from Freebird often, or from the UK, from NME or whatever. You had that luxury of just going in there. Listen, like a great band, you created a world for us there. Joseph O'Connor, thank you so much for doing that. And just here's a taste of the most underratedly influential band of all time. This is Roxy Music and Love is the Drug.
It's the drug I'm thinking of. Oh, can't you see? Love is the drug got a hook in me. Oh, get that buzz. Love is the drug I'm thinking of.